My name's Joel from Microsoft. I do security and compliance, among other things, for Azure, which is our cloud platform. And today we're going to be looking at some of the new things that you can do using cloud in production workflows. I think we're starting to reach a point where all of these things can be cloud-enabled, whether you're talking about pre-production, editorial, rendering and VFX. All these things are starting to come together where the tools themselves are fitting into cloud workflows, and even some of the platform capabilities are
starting to appear there as well.
The problem is, I spent hours on these stupid animations, people are making them all Hollywood ready, and then now it's not working. Anyway, so what you would be seeing is all of the things like flying around and moving and doing stuff, but in lieu of that, as I mentioned, we're reaching that state in the industry, reaching that state in the industry where everything from the initial point of ingest of being able to get do your workstation and editorial level work, at the front end, start to move these things into the cloud where you have software services and platform services available for doing things like video analytics to be able to do speech and facial recognition, as well as being able to stream your services out to the endpoint. And then, regardless of the kind of tool that the artists or the production folks want to use, these things are coming into the cloud fold. Of course, you might have seen last year that we did the announcement with Avid, and partnering with them to move their workflows directly into Azure and to enable remote desktop scenarios and being able to do full editorial from a workstation. Being able to do cloud-based rendering, whether you're doing pre-visualization and modeling, all the way out to full burst render workloads in the cloud, where you might be spinning up even tens of thousands of cores. And then at the other end is that play out to the screen of streaming it to anywhere the end customer is going to be, whether it's to a movie theater, to a mobile device. You have that ability to seamlessly move these files and these assets through the cloud. Now, some people wonder, why the cloud? What is it that it does for, particularly for production? As I'm sure you've seen in your own IT environments, it tends to be a very spiky workload. Production starts up, you've got a whole bunch of activity, you're onboarding people, setting up server environments, moving assets, all that kind of stuff. And then things wind down. And if you've purchased a whole bunch of hardware to support that, then that hardware is sitting there. So even though the cost equation, if you look at on-premises versus cloud, when things are all maxed out, it's going to be pretty even. In some cases, cloud might be a little bit more expensive. But at the same time, you don't have stuff sitting there idle, eating up your line item budgets because now it's not being used. There's an economy of scale that comes with cloud and being able to accelerate those production pipelines. So instead of, if your render project is running long or if you're doing something more complex, it's really hard to get another 1,000 servers into your render farm. But in a cloud environment, you can just spin these up literally in minutes. Gives you the ability to scale these projects as well as make things happen faster. In particular with visual effects where it gives you the ability to see things come back so much faster that you're not waiting around for the next iteration of the 300-hour render for that next frame. So what we're going to do is walk through some of what these workflows entail, getting those assets into the cloud in the first place. What happens when you start to do your pre-visualization and rendering? Once all these things start coming together and someone's going to sit down and work with the actual assets and build out a story, as well as what happens to it when it's just sitting there? How are you protecting these very important content files where are they going to go afterwards? I mean, put them on backup drives in your closet, or are they sitting somewhere where you can get at them? And then how do you get it out to those consumers? So on the ingest side, what this really means is taking stuff from a set location, from a visualization partner, and getting it into your cloud environment. Because really what you want is to have this stuff accessible to everybody, whether it's a remote graphics studio in India, or if you have a local editor or a studio executive, the stuff needs to get into the cloud. And there's a couple different ways you can do it. One is by physical transport. Not everybody has a gigabit connection to the internet, so sometimes you need a way to more easily transport data. We announced earlier this year a device called the Azure Data Box, and it's essentially a 70 or 80 terabyte mobile thing that you can just hand off to DHL or Federal Express. It shows up at one of our data centers. We automatically ingest your content into your storage account, and then you just cycle back out. You can have another one show up to your set location. You can fill that up and have it sent off. We've had the import-export capability for a while. That's basically sending however many drives to a data center, and then there's an automatic process for ingesting those. But we also work with partners to enable really large scale, and we've had some examples where your customers have we've rolled in like entire HP racks of drives and been able to plug it into the backbone and move their data that way. So there's multiple different mechanisms for how you can do that. The other way is networking. Like I said, if you have that super high speed trunk, that's great. Not everybody does, but what it gives you is that privacy of a dedicated link. So not only are you getting the speed and the reliability, but it does give you that capacity of extending your environment in real time. First off, you've got moving storage and moving assets, but then you have to be able to interact with those. So whether you're in a studio location or you have remote workers, having this direct pipe means that your environment, your production network, is going to be able to talk to your cloud environment very seamlessly, and you can you can work as if those assets were right next door, when in fact they could be 3,000 or 5,000 miles away. Another technology you might have used before is the Vir, and historically this has been for managing very large data sets that need to sit in the cloud somewhere. Best example is 3D rendering. You have large texture maps, you have large models. Sometimes those assets are going to sit on-prem because that's where everybody's working on them. There's sensitivity around that next superhero movie. You don't want those things to start to leak. So what this does is enable you to have assets locally, yet stream them into your cloud environment, where your rendering orchestration engines can use them in a very high-speed fashion. So Avira has had a lot of experience doing this over the last number of years. Microsoft acquired them a few months ago, and we closed that. And those, that's going to be turned into an Azure platform service so that both the devices and the cloud services can work together. Next up on asset management, and Evan will be talking more about this later this afternoon. But it's essentially being able to have your full editorial workflow in the cloud. It could be, it could also work in a hybrid fashion where you've got some of your assets locally because you've just taken them off the camera, putting them into your media bin, and then you've got a remote editor that needs to start working with proxies. So with the Avid environment and with Media Central and the Media Composer, it gives you that ability to operate in the cloud, but it's a mixed environment, so that your local storage is going to show up in the same browser view or the same tool view as the stuff that's sitting in the cloud. So the artist doesn't really have to care where stuff is sitting. As long as it gets populated into that one repository, then the Avid Asset Management is going to deal with moving those files around, it's going to deal with unifying identity, and making it really feel like this is just one collaborative environment, rather than having to pick up files from one place and put it on the drive and then take it over to your editing station and then take it over to the finishers, and you know, it becomes this big, big hassle. Moving on to visualization, one of our big partners in the UK is a studio called Jellyfish Pictures. They've helped us do a lot of proof of concept and building out of a full render pipeline. So some of the bigger blockbusters that you may have seen recently were actually done with Jellyfish, and a fair amount has been rendered inside of Azure using tools like Maya, Conductor and Royal Renderer for being able to do your orchestration. All of this feeding into a burst rendering scenario where they can go from their on-premises render farm and then take advantage of thousands of cores as needed up in Azure. So how do we get to that point where we're doing our visualization? So the Surface devices is a generation of not just tablets, but of interactive workspaces. So the Surface Studio on the left is about a 28-inch 4K plus display that's obviously also a PC. But it allows you to have that high definition HDR environment where you can work on your content. And through tools like Teradici that give you remote workstation capability, you've got that interactivity. You've got that capability to use the touch interface and to create in a different way. And unfortunately, my animation isn't working. I would like to have been able to show this properly. Let's see if it'll do it now. Yay. So one of our partner studios you may be familiar with is the Third Floor. And so they do a lot of visualization, artistry, and rendering for a number of different studios around here. So we sent one of their artists up, Doug Leffler, with the Surface Studio. And one of the comments that he made is that the medium really does affect the kind of artwork that you can do. So these are examples of things that were done uniquely on a Surface device, in this case a Surface Studio, where he found that he could think in different ways, that the interactivity of the dial that allows you to change parameters of the paintbrush or the pencil, the touch sensitivity and the responsiveness of the screen enables him to do things that he wouldn't be able to do with real watercolors or with pen and paper. So it's going to allow new capabilities and new kinds of artwork to be done. And we'll see if I can get the video to play, because you are among the first to... How many of you were able to stop by the Expo area and see the first generation Surface Hub? So that's something to go look at, because it's basically a large format Surface device. Supports up to 100 points of touch. There's a 55 and an 84-inch version that's full 4K. Supports Skype. Does all these really really crazy things. But
just double check if the audio doesn't work. That it's set to headphones.
Okay, there doesn't seem to be a way to make the video if I try it manually. This is the next generation Surface Hub device. So I don't know if they're going to let me have four of these in my office, but I'm going to guess not. So, next set of technologies that we can talk about are part of the workflow. Obviously, we talked a little bit about Avid, of being able to implement cloud-based editorial. So this could be using a tool like virtual desktop infrastructure or PC over IP that enables you to fully virtualize a workstation in the cloud. You can throw as many CPUs or GPUs at it as you need. Run Media Composer, run all of your plugins, have your licensing managed for you as well. And then remote that to a desktop that could be anywhere in the world. As well as what we talked about of being able to have centralized repositories for all of your media content. One of the other interesting things that's come to the forefront, particularly for media, is the use of artificial intelligence to interpret data. So the creation of metadata, the ability to understand the content that's being put in there and get something actionable back out of it. And it's not necessarily about audience analytics and things like that, although that's part of what you can do too. But in the production workflow in particular, there is a lot of duplication, a lot of errors that comes with taking scenes, having a production assistant sit there and type things in to say, okay, here's who's in it, here's all the camera settings, all that kind of jazz. And then that data gets lost. It's not associated with the camera files anymore. But with artificial intelligence, you can run it through in this case, the video indexer, which can do facial recognition. It'll do speech to text. It can do automatic translation. There is a whole suite of services that are part of it where you can essentially let the machine create all of that metadata for you. And as a result, it becomes searchable. So you have this massive archive of 1.5 petabytes of data for a single large production. Now all of that becomes usable. You say, oh, what about this thing where there was this one scene, this particular actor and that person and so on. You can just go right to that particular asset because it becomes a searchable archive. So speaking of archives, let's talk about how some of this stuff works and how you protect it. So from a pure storage perspective, obviously you're dealing with large amounts of materials. You need a way to be able to back them up. You need a way to protect them, and you need the ability to scale. One of the biggest challenges that we hear from people is the fact that these tape libraries, these disk libraries start to age out. And you have a pretty significant cost barrier there, that as your tape library gets to be about 5 to 7 years old, the tapes start to age, they start to not work anymore. And the same thing can happen with large drive arrays as well. I learned a couple of months ago that something that I didn't know, that if a drive sits idle for a few years, the gaskets start to break down. If that happens, then air starts getting into your device, it will not work anymore. So even if you think that, I've got a huge stack of spinning media that is going to sit there forever, apparently it won't. Because if you don't go in and check them at least every 12 months and spin them up and let them breathe, then they won't. And of course, with tape libraries, you have the challenge of then you've got that next generation that comes, and you've got to port everything over into the new format, or you don't have access to it anymore. So we've got a couple of options around that. But I think more importantly is the ability to protect those assets. So on the one hand, you want there to be an SLA. You want to be able to access these assets, but you also don't want them leaking. So there are a variety of mechanisms that allow you to encrypt. We have partners that provide watermarking that really is around creating a secure workplace and a secure asset library for an individual production. You can manage the encryption keys. You can manage the licensing. So it doesn't matter you know, whether these are on-prem assets, because there's something called the Azure Stack that allows you to have kind of a piece of the cloud sitting on-premises. And you can run all of the same identity and access management solutions, and all of your asset management, everything is there. And then you can extend that to the cloud where the same security mechanisms are in place to protect it. But on the archive side, there's certainly a better way to do it than tape backups. So from a tiered perspective, you have, of course, hot storage, which is everything that you're working with. That could be, you know, spinning media, that could be a super high-speed SSD, you know, arrays of drives running in the cloud that, you know, that are going to allow you to, you know, that's how you carry out your day-to-day work. But as the content, you know, gets utilized, as the materials start to age, you want to move them out to, you know, cheaper storage, and things that you're not going to access quite as much. So we move from, you know, the instantaneous access of nearline storage to basically, instead of it being available in microseconds, then it might be minutes to retrieve it from cold storage. But then as the project finishes and you don't need all these things anymore, you can automatically move it all to cold storage, where the cost of maintaining it there is negligible, but you don't have to do that maintenance. There's no tape library, there are no, you know, disk farms, you don't have to worry about format changes. It just sits there. It's in immutable storage. When you need it, you issue a request, and the stuff is automatically pulled. You know, from whatever media that we have in the back end, you know that it's still going to be there. And you know, within a couple of hours, the request gets fulfilled automatically, and those assets come back. And everything is fully searchable. So everything that you put into archive that has been fed through the video indexer now has those tags on it. So if you come back to a project 10 years later and you don't know what things are, where they are, it doesn't matter, because you can just search against that content library that's sitting in archive, and now you can start pulling these things back and make use of them today, you know, instead of you know, having to go and find whatever editor it was that worked on it 10 years ago and probably doesn't even remember what it was. So I know that was super fast, that was a lot to take in. If there's any questions, I'm happy to take that now, or feel free to stop by our table up there, and we can get you even more details. So, question.
Your take on Kubernetes and clusters and serverless for this whole thing?
So the question was about doing containers and serverless computing. That's going to be a big part of this moving forward. A lot of it is up to how our ISV partners build their products and solutions to use containers. But you know, there's a lot of rich capabilities within the platform to essentially support any container metaphor that you can think of. Some of Azure Data Services are going in that direction, but you know, it's kind of on an as-need basis of where does it make sense to do that. You know, I think you'll start to see, you know, see things like watermarking could definitely go that way.
Can you talk about DRM and encryption?
Yeah, absolutely. So for DRM, it's actually built into Azure Media Services, so you can do license distribution and management for content. Things can be encrypted to particular clients, can be encrypted based on identity. Supports basically all known playout formats, Smooth, Dash, HLS, you know, Livevine, PlayReady, AirPlay. Yep. Other questions? In the back.
Overcome resistance due to security issues with real or imagined.
So it's a question, have people overcome the security?
How do you overcome?
Oh,
what do you say to people, let's say, yes, Joel, it all sounds great, but I have security concerns putting sensitive media in the cloud?
I'm glad you asked. So if we go back and look at, you know, security is an interesting thing because it can be extraordinarily complex. But at the same time, if you can remove the barriers of the end user and the people who are trying to implement these systems and make it simple for them to use, then it's going to be a lot more secure. So that's where we put a lot of attention not only from a governance perspective, but also with enabling security within the platform that is just there, whether it's encryption address for for all media, all hard drives, all data that a customer is going to put into a cloud environment, to customer managed keys, to secure networking. Every virtual machine that gets implemented within Azure has a firewall underneath it. There's a gigantic threat analysis and mitigation system that is pervasive throughout the platform. So we are constantly scanning and intercepting DDoS attacks and malware and all these things that that you would otherwise have to deal with in your own environment. A lot of this is just taken care of natively in the cloud. Another aspect that people are frequently concerned about is, how is my stuff going to mix with other people's stuff? If all customers everywhere around the planet are all in the same cloud, how are you protecting my stuff? And that really comes down to isolation. That your environment is yours. It's not quite the same as being able to go and wrap your arms around the servers that are sitting in your closet, but it really, it functions in exactly the same way. A tenant within the cloud is an isolated instance. It's its own organization. It's its own network environment. Its own identity environment. So there is no way to go from one cloud subscription to another without configuring it. So even by default, there's no way to get in and out of a cloud subscription. So if you don't enable these network connections, there's no way for anybody to backdoor their way into it. So there's so much that's taken care of for you, at the platform level. So from hardware, operating system, software services that are going to make it so much smoother for you to be able to shift workloads into the cloud. And we take this very seriously from a governance perspective as well. Guy mentioned it first thing this morning. The Trusted Partner Network is coming. This is the unification of the standards and guidance programs between the Motion Picture Association and the CDSA. But over the last couple of years, we've been working with those organizations and not only adapting these standards to the cloud and helping to define the next generation, but also making sure that our cloud environment is up to spec for the industry. The two main standards for that, which are the Motion Picture Association and the CDSA Content Protection and Security Standard, we've gone through these. We've done the audits and assessments, we've done certifications, and those are specifically for this industry. We also have 70 other standards and certifications that we audit and attest to. These are through the big four auditing firms and federal government and healthcare and anything else that you can think of. If there's a cert for it, we probably have it. We take it seriously. Data privacy, GDPR. A lot of you are probably getting a little hot on your collar about these privacy standards that are coming from the EU. The cloud is set up to deal with that. Whether you need to isolate an instance in Europe, ensure that data is not moving out of region, all of these things are configurable within a cloud environment, making it a whole lot easier to deal with those regulations in the future. Oh, great question.
There's definitely time for questions, and thank you, Joel. Just so everybody knows, we have about 5 more minutes until we get started in the main room. The breakout started a little bit later, so feel free to answer any questions you wish to do. But after this, feel free to join us back in the main session for the next few things, the panel and afternoon keynote. Thank you all so much.
All right. Thanks so much, everyone.